via teleconference in accordance with Executive Order N2520 and N2920. Members of the public may virtually attend the meeting remotely using the Zoom platform. The public may listen to and/or participate in the Vina Groundwater Sustainability Agency Board meeting via landline or mobile telephone or via computer with both video and audio enabled or audio only. If you wish to comment on an item but do not wish to participate during the meeting, the public may submit comments prior to the meeting via email to vinagsapublicomments@chicoca.gov. Please submit emails with the subject line public comment item number and reference the agenda item number. And the public is encouraged not to send more than one email per item or comment on numerous items in one email. Just as a couple of reminders, we should not be using the chat function, perhaps with the exception of letting the host know of any kind of computer problems that we're having. All comments should be either written through the Vina GSA public comments at chicoca.gov email or spoken orally so that it can be captured in the meeting. Members of the board, when you are speaking, would you please introduce yourselves by name so that we can track who is speaking? So we'll start with a roll call.
Thank you, Chair Schwab. Commissioner Tuzinski, I mean board member, sorry. Board member Tuzinski. Too many
Here.
boards I'm on.
I am here in that whatever capacity you want to call me.
Okay, sorry. Board member Lambert.
I'm here.
Board member Rohr.
Here.
Board member Cooper.
Here.
And then Chair Schwab.
I'm here. We'll start with the consent agenda. All matters listed under the consent agenda are being considered routine and enacted by one motion. Does any board member wish to pull any of the consent agenda items? Are there any public comments on the consent agenda? And if someone from the public wishes to speak, how do they communicate that to us?
They would raise their hand through the
reactions.
Yeah, reactions. I think it's reactions is where it's at, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
If I can, and if they're on the phone, is it star six?
I believe so, yeah. Or star nine. I think it's star nine and then star six if they can't hear, we can't hear them.
Okay. All right. So I don't see any.
Star six unmute.
Oh. We have someone, Deborah Lucera, has raised their hand.
Hi, I just sent in a question about the packet, the materials. I just wondered when I checked online and clicked the meeting packet, it just came up with the agenda. And I'm just wondering if it's attached in the agenda or if there was separate packet or items.
Did you look under additional documents or just under the agenda?
Just under the agenda, because I did. It didn't say to do that. It just
yeah.
Said
so I believe that the packet's under. I'm going there now, but I believe the packet's under. To the let's see.
It's further down under the.
It's agenda. Further down, yeah.
The agenda with the packet PDF. It's the next link below agenda.
I was able to find them on the website. That's how I downloaded mine.
Yeah, it's titled Vina JPA Agenda 2010-14 Packet. That would be the full packet under the agenda.
Okay, so it's embedded in the agenda. I'm sorry.
No, it's a separate document below the agenda only on the website. So if you go into the board meeting on October 14, you'll see the agenda is the first bullet. The second bullet should be the whole packet.
Okay, thank you.
No other questions or comments, so I will entertain a motion for the consent agenda approval.
I'll make a motion that we approve the consent agenda.
And that was made by?
Oh, sorry. Board Member Tuschinski, make the motion to approve the agenda.
Lambert, second.
Can we have a roll call vote?
Sure. Board Member Tuschinski?
Aye.
Board Member Lambert?
Aye.
Board Member Cooper?
Aye.
Board Member Roer?
Aye.
And Chair Schwab?
Aye. Item 4 is business from the floor. Members of the public may address the board at this time on any matter not already listed on the agenda, comments being limited to 3 minutes. The board cannot take any action at this meeting on requests made under this section of the agenda. So if a member of the public would like to address us, please use the reactions key for hand up, or if you're on the telephone, hit *9.
So we have one member, Mr. Brobeck.
Good evening. I also sent this comment in via email today, so you don't have to take notes on my comments. The August 14 Colusa Groundwater Authority and Glenn Groundwater Authority Technical Advisory Committee meeting discussed the importance of interbasin agreements. Mary Fahey from the Colusa Groundwater Authority said the Northern Sacramento Valley Interbasin Coordination Group has formed to meet the SGMA requirement that GSAs coordinate across basin boundaries to assure that management in one basin does not prevent nearby basins from achieving sustainability goals. According to the minutes of the August 14 meeting, the Interbasin Coordination Group has been formed and is being facilitated through a DWR Facilitation Services grant with Butte County. My comments that I wrote are more extensive than this, but I don't want to read the whole thing. But I do want to insist that the public must be included in transparent procedure and meetings of the Northern Sacramento Valley Interbasin Coordination Group. That's my comment. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. We will go to the regular agenda. 6.1 is discussion of the draft basin setting chapter for the Vina Groundwater Sustainability Plan, the GSP. We have a report by Dr. Christina Buck.
Yes, thank you. Good evening. I'm going to try to share my screen here. Hold on. Okay, can you see the main slide or do you see the notes section? Okay, looks good. All right, well, thank you. It's kind of exciting to bring this forward as I think it's a significant step in our development of the groundwater sustainability plans and that whole process. So as you know, just kind of where we've been, the basin setting project was a project led by David's Engineering and their team for all three of the sub-basins. And it developed portions of the plans for Vina, Wyandotte Creek, and the Butte Subbasin. And then draft documents were available this summer and were out for public review. And so that's what we're gonna talk about today, give you some highlights from the document, some of which are addressing some of those comments that we received kind of generally and pointing out some of the important points I think that are in those the basin setting work, and then open it up for any questions that you all have on the document or on comments that were submitted and potential direction on a couple of items. So we'll get to that as well. So this is, you've seen this slide probably multiple times in different forms, and it just highlights the main components of the groundwater sustainability plans. So this work carved off the basin setting chapter, which includes the hydrogeologic conceptual model, the groundwater conditions, and the water budget. And it will also include a section on management areas that has yet to be kind of inserted in there. And then the monitoring networks chapter as well. And that's in partial form as well. It currently describes the current state of the monitoring network, and what will come and be added to that chapter is the representative monitoring and assessment improvement as we work through the kind of the next big phase, which is sustainable management criteria. So I want to point out first that the groundwater dependent ecosystem work is part of the basin setting, and the regulations require that groundwater dependent ecosystems are identified and described in the basin setting. That work is underway. It was on a little bit different track, and Kelly Peterson has been leading that. And so that will be added to the basin setting document shortly for kind of its next iteration. But in the meantime, that work will be available and incorporated into considerations for sustainable management criteria development. So stay tuned for that. The SHAC is actually going to get an update and description of that effort at their next meeting. But a couple of comments kind of pointed that out. So I wanted to give you an update on that. So one of the things I want to talk about, the document describes the hydrogeologic conceptual model. That's our kind of description of our understanding of the subbasin. Geology, hydrogeology, all of that. What I want to take a minute to highlight today, there's a lot of different, groundwater is difficult, right, to kind of picture. And so there's a lot of different ways that we, different pieces of information and data that we put together to try to get an understanding of what's going on with the groundwater system. Wells are an important piece of that, not only for groundwater levels that we can look at from well data, but also when a well is drilled, you know, the driller can log or a geologist can log what material was encountered at different depths, and that helps us get these little pictures or windows into what the subsurface looks like. We also partnered with Stanford as part of this project, the AEM survey. We fondly refer to it often as the helicopter project. And so I wanted to just mention this. Some of this work got into the basin setting, but this is another piece of information that's helping us refine our understanding of our subbasin, the hydrogeology, the structure. And one of our main driving questions in this was to better understand what is the layering of our groundwater system look like? And therefore then what is also kind of the implications related to vertical connectivity, shallow zones, deeper zones and shallower zones in relation to each other, to Tuscan formation, to Tehama formation, and how those kind of interact within this aquifer system. So more on this, we had originally scoped a webinar, I think it was back in April, to have the researchers, Dr. Rosemary Knight from Stanford is lead. We were one of three pilot projects for this AEM study that you see in the picture there covers portions of Butte County, but also over into Glenn County. And this work is continuing. We will have the April webinar got canceled because everything got canceled back then, and that will be rescheduled. So stay tuned for more details, but I wanted to provide a couple highlights from what's in the document. So first, before I do that, I wanna say something about some terminology. Now this is very kind of technical, jargony maybe, but we're doing a groundwater plan. So I think we need to start to understand some of these terms, and you're gonna hear them a lot. So I just wanted to take a minute to describe partly what we're talking about. So there's hydrogeological units describing kind of what is the sediment type. So we know that groundwater moves, water moves easily, right, through coarse grained materials like sand and gravel. It's highly transmissive. It allows water to move through it readily. Fine grained material, clays and silts, doesn't allow water to move through it very well, right? That is a poorly drained soil, but it can hold quite a bit of water. So those are the types of characteristics that we use to describe groundwater systems and how much they kind of transmit or store groundwater. So hydrogeologic units help us understand what the layering is between these coarse grained materials, which is our aquifer materials and our fine grained materials. And that's distinct from what you might say stratigraphic units. And with that, think geology. So with geology, we hear a lot about the Tuscan aquifer, right? Tuscan formation, Tehama formation, Quaternary deposits are on the shallowest part where recent alluvial stream river action has deposited those materials. So I just want to kind of create this distinction between the formations that are made up of a combination of sediment types, fine and coarse grained materials. And so when we talk about the Tuscan aquifer system or the Tuscan aquifer, it is a combination of these inner layerings of fine and coarse grained layers that can be sandstone, mudstone, you know, you see that over in that other, or just thick packages in some cases of sand and gravel. So with that, here's a very pretty but complicated picture from the basin setting document. And this was developed by Dr. Todd Green from Chico State, who's working on the AEM using data from a researcher at Stanford, whose last name is King. And so what I want to highlight here, this I just pulled out of this figure of this cross section here off the map. It goes from the east side of the valley across over southwest of Chico, and that's this section of what you're looking at here. And so the reds are coarse dominated materials. So there could be fine grained material in there as well, but it's generally coarse dominated. So lots of sand and gravel layers. And the blues are fine grained material or fine dominated materials. And so you can see just if you start on the east over here and you move to the west. So here's, if you were taking a walk across this cross section, you'd run into Highway 99 right here. And in this figure is also well data. So well data is critical for interpreting the AEM data that's collected by the helicopter. You continue, you run into the Midway over here. So this is the vicinity of Butte Creek. And you see on here, the black lines are interpreted geology based on the AEM data. So the colors are giving you information about aquifer materials, sand and gravel in the reds, or fine grain materials in the blues. The black is indicating LT for Lower Tuscan. So we see this Lower Tuscan that dives down deeper as you move to the west. And then in the western area, we have this Upper Tuscan Tehama. In the west, the Tuscan and the Tehama kind of inner finger or inner layer. And from the AEM data, you can't tell them apart. So that's why that area gets kind of that combined Tuscan Tehama. And at the very top is a thin layer, 50 to 100 feet of the Quaternary deposits. So let me just see. So that's kind of beginning to help us understand kind of picturing the groundwater system a little bit better, but also just understanding groundwater flow, right? Groundwater flows more easily in coarse grain materials. So over on this east side, you can see that recharge, natural recharge that enters the system over here on the east can also move down in depth as it moves to the west into and become part of the groundwater system in this deeper part in the western zone. So it's just helping to kind of put these pieces together. And we see in some places connection, vertical connection and shallow zone groundwater level conditions are very similar to what we see in the deep zone. In other areas, particularly in the west over here, there's a well right here by the Sacramento River where the shallow zone is influenced. You can see influence from the Sacramento River, but not as much from pumping and it doesn't kind of follow the same patterns as what you see in this intermediate wells that are in the intermediate and deeper zone. So understanding the context of this greater kind of hydrogeologic structure of the subbasin also helps us interpret and understand what the wells are, what conditions the wells are monitoring at different depths. Okay, so I'm gonna skip that one and just go on from there. So that's just a couple high points from the hydrogeologic conceptual model piece and addresses a little bit some of the quite a few of the comments related to aquifer zones and the point that we've defined the system as having one principal aquifer. That's kind of tricky. It's in the regulations. You have to define your principal aquifers. That doesn't mean that we can't incorporate what we know is a complex system and has these different layers and different zones that are connected in some places and maybe less connected in others. But together, it makes up kind of this one principal aquifer. At least that's the path forward at this point. But as we develop sustainable management criteria, we're not gonna treat the whole system as one big bathtub. as kind of that single principal aquifer term might imply, kind of oversimplification. Okay, so moving on to the water budget piece. Water supplies in the Vina sub-basin just highlights here, mostly, as you know, groundwater dependent basin, but there are some surface water diversions that are used for agricultural irrigation. About 8% of the total water supplies in the basin are surface water. The rest is groundwater for ag pumping, 82%, and urban pumping, 10%. And you can see how that varies from year to year. Generally speaking, the surface water here in the blue is pretty consistent across years, except in the most critically dry years, 2015, where surface water can take a significant hit. But otherwise, the groundwater pumping varies from year to year, and we'll look at that in more detail. So there's two drivers really behind these water supplies, right? One is hydrologic variability, wet and dry years. This is a graph of Sacramento Valley Index, water year type index. So blue are wet years, above normal and below normal are the green and the yellow. Dry is orange, and critically dry is red. So you can see just on the left some stats about long-term averages, and then this 50-year average. We're showing you this time period, 1971 to 2018. That's the time period that the Butte Basin Groundwater Model, which is the tool we're using to develop these water budgets, that's the time period of the model that has, it has input data over that time period. And you can see that that 50-year time period, if you add two more years onto it, that makes it 50 years, has pretty close to the same average water year type index as a longer 100-year time period. And even this 2000 to 2018 time period, which is what has been defined in the basin setting work as the historical period, kind of surprisingly also has a similar average precipitation to the longer average. So I think that's interesting to note. We know that we had kind of historically wet years, right? The new historically wet year, I believe, was in 2017, and some critically extremely dry years. And so the last 20 years hasn't really looked like the last 50 in terms of wet and dry year cycles. But the average, you kind of lose that in just looking at the average. Okay, so the other thing that drives water demands, other than hydrologic variability and conditions, of course, is land use and what's being done on the land. So agriculture makes up 45% of the land area of the subbasin, developed land, which is urban area, but could also include roads and things like that, is 13%, and then native is about 42%. And then you can see how the different crop types have changed over time between kind of the major crops, rice, orchards, all the other crops, and then idle. And just want to point out that idle is irrigated land that's currently not planted. So it could be a plot that was an orchard and has been pulled out and is going to be planted again. Or some of that acreage could be rice acreage that for whatever reason as an annual crop was not planted. Maybe it was a wet spring or other reasons that that land is normally an irrigated crop but wasn't in that year. So that bounces around a little bit as well. Okay, so that leads us to the water budget results. This is a summary table out of the document that has the water budget for the groundwater system for these different scenarios. And we're gonna talk about that a little bit more. The historical, like I mentioned, is the time period from 2000 to 2018. And so it's each of these inflows and outflows essentially to the groundwater system is averaged over that time period. And then we have essentially four, what I would consider kind of model scenarios or water budget scenarios. The current scenario reflects a 2016 land use footprint with 2016 to 2018 average urban demands. And then the future conditions starts with the 2016 land use and changes it to reflect what's in the 2030 Butte County General Plan. So generally urban growth. And then the climate change scenarios change the hydrology. So when we do, which includes changes to precipitation, stream flows, and evapotranspiration. So we're essentially looking at these two major drivers of change on the system. One, changes in the land use footprint, and two, potential changes in hydrology driven by climate change. And you can look at put those scenarios together, run the model, look at the results, and start to understand how those changes affect the different components of inflow and outflow in the groundwater system. So just a peek at historical results. There's obviously a lot more in the document. I'm just gonna show you this one slide with a couple kind of high points. This graph is from the report, shows the black line. I've got your faces are in the way on my screen. Okay, so the black line is groundwater pumping. Over time, over this historical period, so 2000 to 2018, the bar for each year is just colored based on that water year type. So blue is the wet and the red is critically dry, everything in between. So you see that groundwater pumping is sensitive to water year type, right? We have lower, less groundwater pumping. This is largely driven by agricultural demand, irrigation demand. Less during wet years, higher during dry and critical years. And it goes up and down kind of over the course of this 18-year period, largely driven by that. Otherwise, it's a pretty pretty flat trend line over the 18-year period. The dotted line is the change in storage. So starting with essentially a starting point of zero in 2000, just for comparison, you can see how groundwater in storage changes from one year to the next. And the blue bars show that within that 1 year, and then it's cumulative with the dotted black line. So change in storage is also sensitive to water year type, as we would expect, right? We have greater demands, greater pumping demands during dry years, and less precipitation, so less natural percolation. So dry years get kind of a double hit. Likewise, they get a double benefit in the wet years, less groundwater demand, and more natural recharge from precipitation and stream flows. So this table below just shows what the average change in storage is for these different water year types. So big swings, wet years, we see a bump to groundwater storage in a wet year of an average of almost 118,000 acre feet. In contrast, in a dry or critical year, if you average those year types, you see a decline in groundwater storage of almost 85,000 acre feet. So big swings depending on what type of water year it is, really driven by, again, these two major drivers: groundwater demand driven by agricultural irrigation largely, and then hydrology, what water year type it was. So overall, if you look at this time period, from 2000 to 2018, you see a cumulative change in storage of just over 400,000 acre feet. And so if you average that over the 18-year time period, it leads you to this number that has been kicked around a lot and is in this report of almost 20,000 acre feet per year decline in groundwater storage. So that's where that comes from. Okay, so that's based on the historical results, which basically means that our information on land use is estimated and changed each year over the whole model time period, but we focused on these 18 years, more recent 18 years. And it means that, you know, we're using historical precipitation, historical estimates for ET, all historical estimates for stream flow inputs, all of that. So that's the historical model runs, which leads to these results. Okay, so then we can switch gears a little bit to the water budget scenarios. And again, I like to look at these to think about what's the sensitivity of the system to these different types of changes. So how does the system respond to changes in land use? If we run the model with kind of our current footprint of land use, what does the water budget look like, and what pieces of the water budget are different than what we saw in the historical with future? And I mentioned that that's based on general plan footprint. And then if you change the hydrology to a climate changed hydrology. So back to this summary table, just kind of focusing on these four columns, which is the result of these scenario runs. I've looked, you know, kind of started with the current as essentially a baseline scenario, and then looked across the row to see how how do these different terms change? And just generally, as you layer in future growth, which is essentially future development, and then changing climate, and then a little bit more extreme changing climate, subsurface inflows generally increase. So there's a little bit more inflow from the neighboring area. Deep percolation also generally increases. This is a little bit odd, but it's if you dial into some of the details here, it's in part driven by an increase in deep perc from applied groundwater. So that's not really a new inflow. You know, that's if you look at net groundwater pumping, you would maybe subtract that off because you pulled it out of the ground in the first place and then some of it goes back down. So a little bit of increase in deep percolation. Seepage from streams stays pretty consistent, and we'll take a look at why that might be the case. So it's not that sensitive to the current kind of land use or changing hydrology. Subsurface outflows generally go down a bit, you know, from 76 to about 67. So less water flows from the Vinasud Basin into the neighbors. Groundwater pumping goes up. This is kind of the biggest change. So estimated groundwater pumping, this is driven by the agricultural groundwater pumping, goes from about 5,000 to over 206. So essentially having a current conditions 2016, which is using 2016 land use as our most recent available spatial land use data, that combined with what we expect climate change, at least as simulated here, to do to precipitation and stream flows, it's expecting groundwater pumping to go up. Groundwater demand is going to go up. And then western boundary net outflows goes down. So essentially, if these changes drive a higher groundwater demand, the system rebalances with that extra groundwater extraction by having less water inflows come, there's more water that comes into the system, less that goes out, and the net boundary outflow at that western boundary also goes down a bit. And I'll zoom in on that that piece as well. Okay, so now we can look at, those are annual average numbers. Those are helpful, but it's also good to look at kind of the time series or how these numbers change over time and in different water year types. So this is a graph over the 50-year time frame of this model run scenario for these four different model runs. The current condition, future with no climate change, and then future with the 2030 climate change, and future with 2070 climate change. And you can see that largely it's going up and down. We don't have the water year types on here, but kind of a similar patterns as we saw before. Things are going up. This is the wet time period. This was the 90s drought. Things came up. And then we've been on this kind of decline with periodic upticks in those wet years. This is actually pretty similar if you look just at this 20-year period. The decline from, you know, here to here is a bit over 400,000 acre feet also. So if you divided that by the 20 years, it's close to 20,000 acre feet too, and maybe a little bit more. So that's important to note on this table. We saw 19,000, almost 20,000 from the historical, and then it drops to 1,000 to 2,000 for these model scenarios. That's in part because it's averaging over this whole 50-year time period. So it looked at, you know, from zero to negative 50,000 over 50 years is about 1,000 to 2,000, right? But if you look at just the 18 years, it's not all that much different from the historical. I welcome questions on that if you have any. So just a couple last things here. One thing I want to highlight is interconnected surface water. One of the undesirable results that we're going to have to address is depletions of surface water. So a part of the basin setting is to recognize and describe how the surface water system is connected to the groundwater system. And this is just a figure that shows kind of what that relationship what drives that relationship. And that really is the difference between what level the stream is at and what level the groundwater is at. If the stream, water moves from high to low, right? So if the stream is higher than groundwater, water moves from the stream to the groundwater. If the groundwater system is higher elevation near the stream than the stream, then water is moving from the groundwater system into the stream. And so that's what we're talking about when we say a gaining stream. It's gaining water from the groundwater system, or a losing stream means it's essentially recharging the groundwater system by water moving from the stream to the groundwater. And then if it's disconnected, then it's essentially always losing. Water's never moving into the stream because the water levels are deep enough that it's not intersecting that stream bed. Okay, so some results from the basin groundwater model suggest that most of the streams in the Vinus subbasin, which are shown by the colored lines here, are largely losing essentially almost all of the time, almost or all of the time. So there's a considerable amount of uncertainty in this, but it basically means that in most areas where these streams are, especially on the east side, groundwater is deeper than where the stream bed is, which isn't, you know, that's reasonable probably in most of these places if the stream bed is 10 to 20 feet below, you know, the surrounding land area, land surface. But where we do see more connection is as you move to the west. So the Sacramento River has areas that are mostly gaining, areas that are mostly losing, according to these results. And then some of these streams as well, as you move, Big Chico Creek, as you move to the west, has a mixed stretch of sometimes it's losing, sometimes it's gaining, as well as Mud Creek, Sycamore Creek, Pine Creek. I think this is Rock Creek, actually. We need to label these. So this will be important as a starting point for establishing sustainable management criteria as well related to interconnected surface water. So I wanted to highlight that. Okay, and then finally, I wanted to talk about this issue of the western boundary and kind of how it's being handled and why. And we've received some comments on this as well. So a couple pieces of information that are important. One is that the Butte Basin groundwater model only, the extent of the model only goes to the Sacramento River. So, and then east of that. So this is a limitation of the Butte Basin groundwater model. And essentially that boundary then is not only a river and a boundary between subbasins, but also the edge of the modeled area. And that means that model results are a bit less reliable on the boundary. And because the interplay between level, the level in the stream, the level in the groundwater system is what defines gaining, losing, reaches. It's hard to disentangle that when it's occurring on the boundary of the model. So that's why in this case, in the water budget numbers, we've done a net western boundary flow rather than splitting out those numbers as subsurface flow, inflow or outflow, and Sac River interaction, inflow and outflow. That is something that needs to be addressed, and it's still kind of currently in process. So Jim Brobeck mentioned the Northern Sacramento Valley Interbasin Coordination Effort. It is underway right now. It's staff level coordination, and consultant teams are working to compare water budget numbers from these different regional models that our neighbors are using. So the Butte Basin model has this limitation of only going to the Sac River, but there are other models, the Central Valley C2VSIM, and then also the Sac Valley simulation model, which are also both IWFM models. That's just the modeling code. But there's some consistency in approach between the Butte Basin groundwater model and these other regional models, but they cover the entire Sac Valley. And so we really need to look at the results of those models and see what they're suggesting about the Sac River, how it's interacting with groundwater and the groundwater flow across these boundaries. And then those regional models should inform our understanding of our subbasin as well. So right now, the Butte Basin model, it relies on input from an earlier version of one of those regional models. So we are closely tied with our neighbors, and that this is something that is currently being refined and understanding better what the flow is across that boundary and with the Saco River. And it's going to be a long-term issue that we're going to need to refine as we march through SGMA, you know, in five-year updates and longer. Okay, so we can switch gears to just summary of the comments. I've mentioned kind of along the way a few of the different natures of comments that we've received. This is just straight out of the staff report, so I'm not going to read it, but just want to point out that there were a number of comments highlighting the importance of these multiple aquifer zones and the pressurized nature of the deep zone and understanding vertical gradients and flow paths between shallower and deeper portions of the aquifer. And that has implications for a number of things. A number of comments also pointed out deficiencies in monitoring information that we have for the shallowest portions of the groundwater system. And that has importance both for groundwater dependent ecosystems and in some places and areas for domestic wells also. So that's a topic that the SHAC spent quite a bit of time talking about, and that we're also looking for discussion and input from you all on that piece. And then there were some other comments on rooting depths of Valley Oaks and groundwater dependent ecosystems. Like I said, that whole piece of GDE is still to come in the document. So largely comments related to our hydrogeologic conceptual model and how we're really understanding how this system works, both through kind of the description of the aquifer system itself, as well as some of the monitoring groundwater level condition information that's in the document. A couple other issues that have been raised that I've mentioned are the importance of understanding and characterizing interbasin flows. And like I mentioned, that is one of the things, you know, when we were looking at those water budget scenarios and what gives, what kind of adjusts when groundwater pumping increases, interbasin flows is what adjusts, either your inflows to the subbasin or the outflows. So better understanding that is going to be important. And then secondly, climate change impact. And just talking about, you know, the approach that was taken, and I'll just move to this, with climate change was to use data from DWR using 2030 climate change data and then 2070 central tendency climate data. And the SHAC discussed and brought up the fact that other agencies in our region have developed climate action plans, City of Chico and Butte County. And one kind of the curiosity question of how, what data sources did they use and what, how does that compare to what was used for this effort in the basin setting? And do we need to reconcile that if different approaches or data were used? So that's something that we can, your feedback on would also be welcome. So with that, I will stop and welcome any questions or discussion.
Oops. Christina, this is Deborah.
Oh, let's first have discussion from the board, and then we'll open it up to members of the public.
Okay.
Okay. So a couple of issues specifically that the board have been asked for feedback on is the shallow monitoring network and the climate change and water budget sensitivity. So board discussion or comments.
This is Evan Shinsky. I sent Dr. Buck a few questions earlier. I'd like her to drill down a little bit more about climate change, particularly in lieu of the presentation she made. She had a slide that showed the 50-year trending under the four different scenarios. And if I read the slide correctly, I think she may be backing up to it, or maybe it's not necessary. But the bottom lines look like they used past years as the assumptions for the data points on there. Did I understand that correctly, first of all?
Okay, yeah.
Because so I was looking at the bottom, for example. Yes, because like at the end, year 50 says 2005, and then 2004. The other ones are all, you know, the past years in order. That's what made me start to read it. And the trends are relatively similar in that regard. So yeah, I'd like that explanation, and then I'll leave, that leads me to my broader question.
Okay, yeah, great question. So essentially what was done was, and this is typical for climate change kind of analysis, is to take the historical hydrology. So that's why those historical years are shown there. And then you perturb those or hit them with some sort of, adjustment based on climate model results related to precipitation. So that basically the time series of historical precipitation that was originally in the model was adjusted based on climate models, downscale climate model information, and adjusted to then be the new precipitation input for this climate change run. But it was originally the historical data set. So that's why you see those historical years along the bottom. Ultimately, it still captures the historical variability, but with some adjustment. And that adjustment can reflect not only overall average increase or decrease in precipitation, for example, but also shifts in timing. And that can be captured in how those data is adjusted. The reason 2004 and 5 are there on the end is because the regulations and DWR guidance require a 50-year time frame for this analysis, and we only had 48 of model data that we had developed up to current 2018 data. And so they chose kind of two relatively average normal years and stuck them on the end.
Right. That made sense to me. And so I was just making sure that I understood that. And that sets up my broader question, which was, again, part of what my question was to you, was about reconciling, which was, again, the word that I had used in my question, metrics that may have been used in by the county and by the city of Chico in their climate action plan. The historical record up until now, suggests, as your data showed, a relatively stable or a consistent trend, but it's possible those other metrics may show a different trend, that maybe there's a different, more dramatic shift in climate that's going to happen, that perhaps this, using these historical data or the way that this has been extrapolated may not match the same. And so I'm curious if that's something based on your experience you think is going to be a very valuable thing for us to include and to again, because this is so important and such a key thing. I happen to have noticed that when you put up the slide 14, that the future climate change and the no impact for 2030 and the no impact of climate change were virtually identical at the bottom line. So that's why this data and how it gets shifted could very well be significant. So big picture question is, the importance of maybe looking at those other metrics, if they do change our data, that could be significant, correct? Or you're the expert and I'm not, so.
Yeah, no, I think that is a good question in terms of saying what do we want to plan for, kind of in terms of how extreme a condition do we want to plan for and how might the hydrology change, in terms of stream flows or precipitation, and then how does that affect other parts of the groundwater system, that we're trying to manage sustainably. So a couple things I think might be worth pointing out, because like you said, between this future no climate change and future 2030 climate change, at the bottom of the table, bottom line, you would say, okay, there's no change in storage, that's both a negative 1700. There's some variation within the table in the details. But I think one thing maybe to note, the reason there's no change is that here they start together, that we're looking now at the orange line and the gray line, they start together and they end together, right? But they don't always track together. So the difference here during dry years, right? During some of these years, for some reason, there's some divergence. And it would be interesting to drill in and see, okay, why are they kind of the same? In some years, there doesn't seem to be an impact of climate change. What's happening in those years where they diverge more? And that helps us better understand what is our system actually sensitive to? In those years, did we see a really more significant shift in timing of streamflow inputs because there was less snow, or, you know, what are the drivers that are leading to why sometimes they're the same and why sometimes they're different? So I think that there's actually a lot of numbers and information here that could be milked a lot more to try to answer some of those more specific questions, depending on really what are we concerned about. And that's kind of why I wrote that in the staff report, is what are, you know, as a board and as a community managing the sub-basin, what are we trying to better understand that may be driving the system? And then I think that we can pull some information out of this, out of the analysis that has already been done, without doing a whole bunch of extra work, just kind of milking the data that's there. And to your point, it's also been raised, you know, if you want to assume something different, kind of a different climate change scenario, what about a mega drought? You could essentially look at this data set as is and say, okay, let's just zoom in on 2000 to 2018. It's been suggested by PPIC and others that there are characteristics in the last 20 years of mega drought. What's going on, you know, in our sub-basin under climate change during that time period, to better understand some of those. So I don't know if that kind of answers your question, but that's partly what you can do with these types of scenario analysis, is to say, how do we want to test our system, and then how does it respond?
Yeah, you answered my question. Thank you. And I'll see how others feel about it as well. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Are there other comments or questions by board members? Okay. Not seeing any, so let's open it up to the public. Looks like we have a couple of speakers. So if you're interested in speaking, please use the reaction key to raise your hand, or if you're on the phone, hit *9. And while we're queuing people up, I'm gonna go close my window so that horn doesn't come through.
See the storm?
Amy, were you saying something? I'm not sure who's.
I was just gonna we can either have Ann choose, or I think Bruce had his hand up first, then Deborah, and then Jim.
Okay. Who's our first speaker?
Ann, I think Bruce had his hand up first.
Okay, so Bruce Smith, was it?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, for the Northern Sector Interbasin Coordination Group, is it possible to bring that and update it to the SHAC at their next meeting?
Yes, I believe we were planning on having it up on the agenda, but yes, we will. We can definitely do that.
Great, thank you.
Anything else, Bruce?
No.
Okay. Who was the next speaker?
Is that me?
I don't know.
I think so.
Yes, so it's Deborah Lucero.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. I had a question. First of all, was your presentation, your slides, is that included in the agenda packet?
It's not, no, but we can post it after the meeting, yeah.
Okay. And then also, these are general questions, and then I have specifics. How do you get things on the VINA GSA agenda? How are things agendized?
That's not a question for me. Does someone else want to take that one?
Well, right now, the items on the agenda is driven by the management committee. And then, of course, if any of the board members want to add anything to the agenda, they would, you know, send it to the chair, I believe, and also us. And then it would be up to the board members to decide whether to agendize an item at a future meeting. That's okay. Typically how it goes.
All right, thank you. So this is for you, Christina. Thank you for the presentation. It's starting to make more and more sense as I hear it more. You had talked about the modeling based on the general plan. What I'm wondering about that is how you use the general plan to determine things when, if, according to your numbers that you're talking about here, we have a 90% ag use and a 10% urban use. And most of the general plan speaks to urban growth.
Yep.
So how does that model work with those percentages?
Deborah, can we have you ask your questions so that we can keep the time current and then staff can answer the questions afterwards?
What? I don't understand what you're talking about.
Well, speakers can have 3 minutes. And so I didn't want to take away your time for asking questions by having staff
answer your questions. You want me to just ask all the questions? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I see. Okay. Sorry. Okay. So that's one of the questions. And then, I mean, I have several, so I may not be able to get them all in. And the other thing that I'm concerned about is the idea that the model only goes to the Sacramento River. And of course, we're still trying to figure out, for instance, in Glynn County, we have learned that in the last 5 years, there have been 70,000 more acres of fruit and nut trees planted in Glynn and 20,000 acres more in Tehama. And so I'm just wondering how we factor in crop use and types of crops planted into these scenarios. I'm also curious about how our own county department interacts with each other. You've brought up wells several times and about the importance of wells and the coordination between environmental health and wells and the Ag Commissioner and Water and Resource Conservation Department. Kind of, I see like a three-legged stool there, how those three departments work together and how data from those departments are gathered and coalesced into this, these concepts. I've also asked you about all of this being based on 2016 land use, which we know that there has been a significant change to our land use in the last 3 years in the three counties that I just mentioned, Butte, Tehama, and Glynn. And then one of the biggest things that I think could be affecting some of this modeling, and I realize that obviously this wasn't convenient, but is our watershed and how the watershed has been affected by the fires and how some of our PMAs that we've been talking about in the shack could be affected by what's going on with the watershed.
Okay, great. Thanks for that lineup of good questions. So I'll just start at the top. You asked about the general plan and the future conditions scenario. So this here's a bonus slide that shows the land use footprints. And you're right, the general plan is driven by development. So it really is, if you compare the current conditions, which is based on the 2016 crop mix land use map with urban, and then the future conditions, it really is just change to the urban area, which largely occurs to the east and within the boundary of the Chico management area. So it doesn't make any assumptions about changes to agricultural land use. Like climate change or other things that we might be concerned about, you could do in the future. We can't do additional model runs at this point, but I think we can use the data that we do have to understand how potential changes in land use could affect the system. And that is to say, okay, if you wanted to make assumptions about expanded agricultural use or a shift in crop mix that may be more water intensive, that would lead you to increased pumping demands, right? And with that, we essentially see increased pumping demands resulting from the climate change scenarios. So no matter what's driving that increased pumping, we can still use these model results to understand if you increase pumping in the subbasin, what gives, like what responds to that. whether that's driven by climate change or by land use, agricultural land use changes. So I think we have some information here without doing additional model runs that we could use to understand that dynamic. Your second question was related to modeling the Sacramento River and the model only going to the Sacramento River extent and what's happening in our neighboring subbasins. Yeah, I mean, that's why the work with the Interbasin Coordination Group is going to be critical in first understanding what water budget numbers our neighbors are coming up with based on these regional models and taking a look at how that compares with what the Butte Basin groundwater model is suggesting. I would tend to defer to the regional models because it's a limitation having the Sac River on the boundary. But we're gonna wanna look at that some more. And so that's what that interbasin coordination is about. It's a technical effort first to kind of compare numbers and compare models. And then it's gonna become a bigger discussion about, you know, depending on what that looks like, what we need to do about it. So stay tuned for that. And we can incorporate, you know, if there's things that we learn from that effort, I can try to bring some of that into this basin setting document. So no promises there, but we absolutely will have that information be part of informing, you know, our understanding when it comes to the next phase of GSP development. Third question was about county departments and their interaction. So environmental health is responsible for well permitting. Our department, you know, does a lot of this kind of water budget and policy and technical monitoring data information. And then Ag Commissioner, of course, has land use data. So are the land use information in the model uses a combination of Ag Commissioner data with spatial data from DWR. So there's connection there and interaction with the Ag Commissioner's office by our consultant team when they put that land use data together. We used to sit on environmental health used to have a well drillers advisory committee, and one of our staff members, I did it for a bit, sat on that committee for some, you know, cross communication and understanding what's going on with the well drillers and with the well permitting. We include well permit numbers in our annual groundwater status report. But I would say that SGMA is kind of upping the ante and the need to more closely coordinate across county departments. And that's gonna include development services, right? Who is dealing with the general plan and potential developments and all of that. So I would expect, you know, right now there is communication between staff and some sharing of data, but that's only going to increase over time, I would think.
And we had talked about a GIS possibly concept for the wells currently too, which would be maybe a project or something.
Right. Yeah. Just understanding where wells are located and having that be part of the well permitting kind of stamp when a well is completed. Yeah. So part of it's data management as well. Existing data that we have, just managing it better or differently. I think your next question was related to the 2016 land use, right? So, and I did ask about this. One of the reasons it only goes to 2016 is because with the Butte Basin model, we need spatial land use information. And so the most recent spatial map of land use was provided by the Department of Water Resources was for 2016. Land IQ is the company that's doing that work for DWR. We're waiting from DWR to get the 2018 map. As soon as we have that, we won't do new model runs with that information, but we can absolutely, you know, look at that and understand what changes have occurred. And again, that can inform kind of the next phase of sustainable management criteria development. So, so we're working with the best that we've got, but as we get more information, we can fold it in either formally in a five-year update or just in real time by pulling it into the available information that we have in the current effort. And you mentioned kind of what's going on in the surrounding counties. I think that that goes into just regional coordination and communication, which is going to be challenging, but necessary, because we know that these sub-basins are connected and part of a bigger Sac Valley groundwater basin, not individual sub-basins. And then lastly, a question about the watershed and how it's been affected by fires. Again, changed conditions, those are going to be important when evaluating. You mentioned, you know, in the context of projects and management actions. So certainly that's going to be critical. And just any sort of big change that occurs in this sub-basin or, you know, could affect the sub-basin, that's an opportunity. That's one of the reasons this isn't a produce the plan and be done forever type of a planning process. We really do need these five-year updates to be able to incorporate big changes and be able to plan accordingly. So I think that's not something to lose sight of, obviously. I do know that Sigma money, there's a program for watershed coordinators. And so I think the other advantage of Sigma is it's really forcing us, and we talked about this already, is really forcing us to integrate all these different parts of the hydrologic cycle and what's going on underground, in the rivers, in the forests. And that's going to take time to do that better and better, but that's where we're headed, I think. So that's good news for resource management.
Thank you, Christina.
Yeah.
And our next speaker is Jim Brobeck.
Yes. I want to thank the board members and the SHAC members for volunteering to devote time to managing and defending our water resources here. Early drafts of the basin setting and the water budget documents revealed critical discrepancies in model outcomes that determine the direction of flow between the regional GSA basins. The first draft of the Butte sub-basin setting result models indicated that about 260,000 acre feet of water flow from the west into the Butte Basin from Colusa, while the first draft of the Vina water budget showed a total of 200,000 acre feet flowing from the east out of Butte into Colusa. These opposing model data form the basis of analyzing the efficacy of experimental recharge projects in Butte County and, conversely, the impacts of groundwater substitution water transfers conducted by the Glen Colusa Irrigation District. Grant David said that from the David's Engineering, which is the engineering firm that we all seem to be using on both sides of the river. He said that this interbasin coordination group is an important topic and there are important differences, especially where the models are taken into consideration. It'll take time to work through the differences. Thad Bettner, the director of the Glen Colusa Irrigation District, has already weighed in on the type of document that he would like to see and explained that the purpose is to catch any potential conflicts of interest or issues that GSID is concerned about. So it was determined at the TAC meeting on the other side of the river that Mr. Bettner would coordinate with David's Engineering's Mr. Clark, who is also a Vina GSA consultant, to discuss an approach, and that Mr. Clark would bring it back to the boards for high-level discussion. Now, Thad Bettner and GSID are players in the water market, as is the environmental community. And in the environmental community is very concerned about how the center basin is going to unfold. Earlier, Christina mentioned that staff is working with, I suppose, the consultants, David's Engineering, I suppose, on this. And I'm concerned that other interests are already weighing in on it, while the public isn't. And I'm wondering, how can we get in there to determine how this interbasin agreement is going to unfold? Because there's some big power players that have already weighed in on it. And those of us in the environmental community have only recently become aware that such an agreement is being composed. How can we weigh in on this?
Jim, your 3 minutes are up. Do you have just one more
comment? That's it.
Nope. Okay, that's it.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
So I'll respond to a couple things and then maybe Paul can talk about the agreement side of things and when that public process might, what that might look like. I think it is a bit confusing in terms of what numbers were put out in the early Butte subbasin. And then how they got combined into this western boundary flow that I talked about earlier also and that Jim just referred to. So first of all, I just want to point out that Vina subbasin, our neighbors in Vina are the Los Molinos subbasin to the north and then the Corning subbasin to the west and then Butte subbasin and a little bit of Wyandotte Creek, hardly anything right here. And then Butte has a little piece of Corning and Colusa, but mostly Colusa. So yeah, those original numbers looked at a major, you know, inflow along that whole boundary, an average inflow of, like you said, Jim, 200 and something, 260 something thousand acre feet inflow. And then what ended up in the basin settings document is a little bit tricky because it essentially combined the flow along this part of the basin, which is where the Sac River is the same as the basin and where I talked about kind of that challenge of disaggregating what's going on with Sac River and what's going on with the subsurface from this stretch of the boundary, which is only boundary and not river. And so it ended up in both places in the Butte groundwater water budget. You don't see that in the Vina water budget. In the Vina water budget, there is no subsurface inflow or outflow from Corning because the only boundary is also associated with the Sacramento River. And so what you see in the water budget results is that net western boundary outflow. But if you peel back into the river interaction section of the basin setting document, you see some numbers that indicate, you know, some significant gains by the Sacramento River, which means that's kind of driving that net western boundary outflow number. So all that to say, it's trickier than it should be, basically, to disaggregate from the Butte Basin groundwater model results what's going on with those boundaries, which is why I'll just say again, we've got to kind of look at what's going on with the regional models and then see what makes sense to better characterize what's going on with our subbasins on those boundaries. I did not attend the TAC meeting that Jim's referring to, so I can't speak to the discussion there. I have heard before about the request that Thad Bettner had made, and my understanding of that was wanting kind of a matrix of what approach are the different subbasins taking on different technical aspects of their GSPs, and just trying to, one, understand that, and two, coordinate when it makes sense. So that may be a useful tool. And then lastly, just to clarify, the Interbasin Coordination Group right now, like I said, is staff from all of these subbasins and their consultant teams. There is quite a bit of sharing of David's engineering, but there are other consultant teams involved in these subbasins or taking the lead. And in some cases, David's engineering is a subconsultant. So that group includes David's engineering, but it also includes GeoSyntech, who is actually now the consultant team leading the rest of GSP development for the Vina subbasin, as well as Wyandotte Creek. And then Montgomery and Associates is involved, Lisa Porter, because they're leading the effort in Corning. And Eddie Teasdale, who is he with now, is working in Las Molinas. So there's a handful of consultants that are part of those conversations because different groups are doing the technical work in different subbasins. And then to the last, I don't know, Paul or someone else maybe want to speak to the public process.
Yeah, this is Paul Goslin. One thing I'll say is that the interbasin interaction is something that we had really highlighted as an important aspect of SGMA when it was getting developed and advocated for this language to get in, because we knew in the Sac Valley, none of the water sticks to political boundaries. We also did produce a report. We got a grant from the California Water Foundation a few years ago, knowing that this was going to be a critical issue on how should this approach be taken. And we worked with GSAs and technical consultants from the Sutter Buttes up to Red Bluff bounded by the two mountain ranges. And that report talked about starting early before you got your plan done with a technical discussion at the technical level and building up and having that transparent in your GSP. So we all had put, and we all collaborated when we got our GSP grant together, we all had put tasks in our grant to do interbasin coordination. And I was going to explain later with facilitation services in my update on the GSP development. That's a task that CBI, Tanya Carlone, is coordinating as part of her task. And the first step we did, and this is going to get into a little bit of the details, was talking to, you know, the GSA managers who were administering the grants to determine, you know, what each of us had put into the grant so we can at least identify some coordination so we're not, we can better utilize the funds we have and how we carry that out. So that was sort of the introduction, trying to get up to speed where we're all at and grant expectations. And then, as Christina said, try to build at least initially the matrix of technical information, which meant we needed to draw upon all the technical consultants to talk about the types of data they have, the modeling, the conceptual model, and that as a starting point. So that's basically been the work that's been going on. Tanya can explain at the SHAC, there's a voluntary cooperation agreement among some basins that you can enter into, and that lists out the same types of information that we're gathering for interbasin to at least understand at least the start where people are at. I don't know if at the end an agreement would need to be entered into, but it's at least a framework to identify the types of data. So the what's going to be coming out in the next month or so, I don't have the schedule, but it will be laying out, you know, that technical information from that process, and that's going to and that'll be done publicly, and that will start, you know, the public discussion and the transparency on this. But it was really just trying to initially compile, you know, the technical information, and you know, some of it is, I will say, kind of mind-numbing. Christina will laugh at me, but yeah, it's pretty deep and pretty detailed. But yes, there's way more to come on this, and this is critically important. It's among one of the most important pieces that we're going to work on.
Okay, I'll bring it back to the board. We are looking to accept that report as an informational item and possible direction to staff, particularly around the shallow monitoring network and the climate change and water budget sensitivity.
Well, this is Evan Tuschinski. I think that the feedback that was received about the shallow monitoring network was good, and it's about the need to expand. And so I think that I don't have anything to add to that. I gave feedback about climate, and I think that Dr. Buck is going to. She responded to me in writing and in this group about. Integrating it. I had gotten the impression simply from the report that it was something that was too massive to do. Again, this is my own wording, but that was too massive to do immediately, and that it was going to be put off until after our initial report and then accomplished later. But her email back to me was that it's something that can be looked at now, and it's something that's going to, and I believe she explained that well here, it's trying to reconcile with other climate models is something that can be looked at and then initially done and then incorporated later on. So I think that would be just kind of my feedback, is just making sure that because we've done some modeling based on one set of assumptions, if there's another set of assumptions that's so radically different, if that's what's determined, it would just be good to know that. And then perhaps if that needs to come back to us, if it requires a whole massive scope of work, or if there's a reason for it and Dr. Buck thinks that's significant for us to do, I think that would be good for us to know. Climate change being such an important potential mitigating factor, as she pointed out, that could be a, you know, if we need to plan for a massive drought or if we need to plan for a massive scenario that's radically different, I think it's something we should be able to consider as one of the variables and one of the considerations for us. So that would just be my feedback.
This is Ann Schwab, and I would agree with Evan, particularly when we're looking at what the difference between the two climate change scenarios or forecast, what are those factors that are making those points separate? Other comments from the board?
Hey, this is Jeff Royer. Quick question for you, Christina. The management areas that you referenced on slide number 2, under basin setting, is that a reference to Vina North, Vina Chico, Vina South?
Right, yep, that's right.
Can you spend a minute or two just explain, you know, what exactly the management areas are for and who's going to be administering them? I mean, is that under us or is that something you're perceiving staff eventually being assigned to or actually having an area manager?
Yeah, no, so the regulations allow for kind of this definition of management areas. If there's geologic reasons to do that or water supply reasons to do that or kind of a variety of factors could lead that definition. But it's all under inclusion in this GSP and under the jurisdiction of, you know, this Vina GSA board. The reason those were delineated kind of in draft in the JPA agreement for this agency was recognizing, you know, there's a different situation in terms of water supply and well infrastructure in the Chico urban area, obviously, compared to, you know, more ag-driven demand in the north and south areas, and even, you know, north or Vina South where Durham is, more ranchettes, more shallow domestic wells there and a little bit different culture. So that kind of set up the definition of those three. As we move through development of the plan, what that does is it allows you to set different criteria, sustainable management criteria in different management areas to avoid undesirable results in those areas. So you have to have a single unifying sustainability goal for the whole subbasin, but it allows some flexibility because conditions may be different in different parts of the subbasin to establish different goals. So that will continue to play out and we can kind of do targeted outreach and work in those three and see, you know, if it still makes sense to define those as they've been put forward right now.
Additional comments?
Steve, I don't have any.
Okay. So direction given?
Yeah, I think that, this Evan Tuschinski again. Yeah, I think the direction is given. I also think that a few things will be answered when we get the groundwater dependent ecosystems part 2. So I think that's going to help too. There was a thing about the Valley Oaks. And again, I know that's a sentinel species. And so again, some of that type of feedback that was in this section, I think will get incorporated when we get the other section as well. So Mr. Brobeck gave us a lot of good information and feedback. And I think some of that again will be incorporated with some of the other things and when other questions get answered in the process. So I feel confident going forward with the couple caveats we've given.
Okay, good. So we'll move to 6.2, update on the development of the Vina GSP and presentation from Paul Gosselin.
Good evening, board, public. So as Christina mentioned, we're completion of the GSP that we're shifting off towards is being supported by staff and Geosyntech as our technical consultant and CBI, Tanya Carlone, who's the facilitator, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. But the three main pillars that are coming up now that we kind of have a good draft basin setting foundation to work from is the sustainable management criteria, representative monitoring wells identification, and then project and management actions. There's a number of other elements that need to go into the plan, A lot of those are administrative or narrative things that staff will work on with the consultant and the SHAC and report to the board. But those three are the real management area topics that are going to be worked on. And they're going to be worked on at the same time, but in an iterative way. So it's going to be a interesting next couple months as we work through them. So sustainable management criteria, and that's getting into evaluating the undesirable results to the uses and use of groundwater. And that includes domestic wells, ag wells, water purveyors, creeks and streams, and groundwater dependent ecosystems. So this analysis from basin setting will be worked into that, evaluate what those conditions look like, and start the discussion on where do we want to set the measurable objectives to avoid undesirable results. So those are being drafted. We're going to have initial discussions on sustainable management criteria with the SHAC in November, just reintroducing the topic. There'll be a presentation in December. We're planning with at least initial numbers. And as we go through December into January, there'll be continued discussions and meetings with the SHAC, reports up to the board. Similarly, with representative monitoring wells, those will be evaluated also. And these are the wells that, depending upon what undesirable results you're protecting, you want representative monitoring wells as indicators to whether you're on your path to achieving your sustainability goal over 20 years. So they're real important to identify and to recognize. So that's going to be worked on in parallel. And then the third leg is project and management actions. And these are things largely that are going to be the means of wanting you to get to your sustainability goal. You can't put your goal out and hope to achieve it at some point 20 years down the road without the means to get there. So that's what the state's going to be looking at. Do we have something that is relevant and reasonable to get us there, and we need to be held accountable to it. So next week at the SHAC meeting, we're going to have an initial presentation, brainstorming discussion of the whole range of the types of things we've seen. It's going to be the beginning of the process to develop potential concepts. And then we'll report up at the next meeting to the board the results of that and keep the board informed. One thing we need to keep, we've been talking about this, is not let project management actions get too far ahead of sustainable management criteria, because you need to know where you're going to know what kind of automobile you need to get to. But you need to start thinking about those things that you like and things that you don't like and things that you might want to just consider in the process, because we ultimately we're trying to get to having these draft chapters you know, out and done for comment you know, by June, to start packaging up the plan. So one thing that we are looking at, you know, ag is the major user, is trying to look at ag conservation and how to characterize that. So we started some discussions with Cooperative Extension and UC Davis, because we're not experts on irrigation. They serve ag, about how do we characterize that. And there was a lot of work done on nitrate management, mostly in the Central Valley, for significant nitrate contamination. So there was a lot of work done to characterize methods on how to characterize ag irrigation practices and trying to identify the most efficient ag irrigation practices and the barriers to those adoptions. So we're looking to try to get some baseline information, particularly in the Vina sub-basin, on that, to one, inventory the irrigation practices, and then hopefully come up with some recommendations on how do we improve ag irrigation efficiency that could lead to reduction in ag pumping. So we're hoping to develop a survey inventory methodology, hopefully in the next couple months. This is still being worked on. We're going to be looking to partner at some point with the Farm Bureau and AUGBC,
maybe almond board. The research is at Davis said that any of these things really only work if there's support and sponsorship with the ag organization. So there'll be more to come on that. The other piece we're working on is facilitation services. So CBI, Tanya Calhoun, has been facilitating the SHAC meetings, and I think that's been real instrumental in keeping the process going. She's really amazing and been able to do a lot of things we would not be able to do as staff. She's also been leading the effort on interbasin coordination among the adjoining GSAs. But the support services from DWR only goes through the end of this year. So we put an application in to continue that, and we've requested continuation of facilitation of SHAC meetings, continuation of interbasin coordination, and then we added an additional task for her to update the communication and engagement plan. If you recall, when we were drafting the JPA, we went through a process also at the same time identifying the communication engagement plan. How should the BINA GSA engage the public? What sort of method should we use in the process? And that was done before we kind of got started here. So it really is timely to update that, get it more current and at a point that it would lead us to towards GSP submission and at least through the first 5 years. So that was tasked and also done in a format that could be suitable for submission into the plan. So that would check one of those boxes. So the request is in, and hopefully the DWR will turn that around and we'll continue with that. One other item, the VINA GSA board did send a letter on September 9th to the governor requesting an extension to the GSP deadline. The Board of Supervisors also sent a similar letter in to the governor. We did talk to other GSAs, the Butte Sub-Basin and Wyandotte Creek. They declined to take action, and in discussions with others, there's some concern too about opening up legislation and what that would mean, and it might invite other things going on, and it, and even setting the deadline in this is coming from other people that there was concern about the sort of the agreement on the deadlines that were put in place. A lot of people, when this was put in, thought us having it submitted in by 2022 was way too long, or the critically overdrafted basins by 2020 was way too long. So tinkering with that could set up some concerns. But at this point, we're waiting. We should, at some point, I expect to get some response from the administration. You know, it's getting towards the end of the year, and then we'll hit the legislative cycle next year. So we'll see what the response is. And with that, I think just schedule-wise, we've been working with GeoSyntec and CBI on the schedule. We did slate out originally some schedule and some workshops, but one of the things, and we'll introduce this to the board, is using a board meeting, let's say when we have sustainable management criteria that have gone through some vetting at the SHAC, we've got some direction from the board, we want to kind of roll it out as a draft before we put out the public comments. Instead of having a separate public workshop, kind of work or design the board as a workshop. So we could just have a single topic, probably be pretty lengthy, similar to what we did with the basin setting webinar, but it would be a board meeting, open to the public, we could present it, and it would be in a workshop format to get input from the board, input from the public. So we were thinking that might be a better way, more convenient for everyone. It would engage the board a lot more directly. So that would really, the main one coming up would probably be in February with sustainable management criteria and in February. So with that, I'll open it up to any questions.
This is Evan Tushinsky. I liked your analogy about wanting to know where you're going before you get the car. That's a good one, and very apt. Also, I think it's good to know the rules of the road before you're going. And so before we get to the projects, are we gonna have that legal assessment that we've talked about at a couple meetings about, particularly for artificial recharge, and make sure that we know all the implications of that? Our legal group had been suspended, as you mentioned, and was going to potentially be reconvened when we need to have that. So do you have kind of a time frame of that in mind? And is that one of the things that you've thought about for this process?
Yeah, and that sort of concept of having that broad paper be put together on the types of recharge and other things and implications. Right now, there's no funding to do that. I thought it was a good project to do, but I think got ahead of what funding we had. But we can still address it. And I think this is where the discussions with the Shack on the types of projects that come up, we're also going to discuss what considerations people have or what concerns they have. And that can drive some legal remedies. And Valerie had talked previously about the range of types of things the Vina GSA could do to avoid any of these undesirable results from, you know, recharge or other things. So I think as we get through specific projects or looking at different actions, we can be more specific and look at the things that are in play and target them for board action. Otherwise, we would have to go through that anyways. Even if we got the paper, it would be general, lay it out, and conceptual, and then we'd need to go back and be specific. So we're just gonna really cut to the chase and be specific on those projects and actions. We also provided the Shack with some other legal analysis. People did summaries of other implications of recharge projects or other things. And so there's other sources out there on issues you need to keep in mind, but we're gonna, I think, deal with the specifics as we get now deep into the project.
Other questions from the board? Are there any questions from members of the public? If you do have any questions, please raise your hand using the reactions key, or if you're on the phone, *9. I don't see any comments. We'll go to communications and reports. These items are provided for the board's information. The board may discuss the items, but no action can be taken at this meeting. Should the board determine that action is required, the item or items may be included for action on a subsequent posted agenda. So we've got committee updates, and perhaps what we can do is hear all the committees and then open it up for questions. 7-1-1 is the Vina Stakeholder Advisory Committee update. Kelly Peterson.
Hi, yes, thank you, Chair Schwab. This is really intended just to be a written report, but I'm happy to entertain any questions that might be on the table.
Let's go to the next report, and then if anybody has any questions, we'll circle back. It's a Prop 1 grant update. Paul Goslin.
Yeah, I have nothing new to report other than, you know, last time we reported it a while ago, we got GeoSyntech under contract, and there's been no action since then. I'll go to 7.1.3 on Tuscan Water District update. Nothing new to report. We're waiting for a notification from LAFCO that an application has been filed. They sent a notice a month or two ago that one may be coming. So until that happens, there's nothing to report.
Okay, any questions from the board on the reports?
This is Evan Tuschinski. I had put this in a written question, and I'll just pose it orally to Kelly so she can elaborate. In her report, she had mentioned that there was some structural and operational recommendations from the Shack to our board for consideration. They're not before us as an action item tonight. So if you could simply explain what the process is for that. It obviously isn't something that's imminent because we don't seem to be considering them tonight. So if you could just explain what the path is for that, that would be great. Thanks, Callie.
Sure, no problem. So yes, as you can see, I did want to just go ahead and point out what the suggested recommendations were from Shaq from the last meeting regarding revisions to charter. Those are actually in the legal court right now, so Valerie is taking a look at those. Those weren't able to get turned around in time for consideration at this meeting to act on by the board, but those will come back to you in November with a track change copy as well as a clean copy as well to look at. And you can basically see the gist of those changes in that written report.
Any other questions? Is there any questions from members of the public? If you have any questions, please raise your hand using the reactions key or star 9 on your phone. Okay, see no questions. So we will adjourn. We'll
Chair Schwab, it looks like Bruce Smith.
Oh, so sorry, I didn't see that. Bruce?
Yeah, on Kelly's presentation, I couldn't hear much of any of it. I have no idea what she was talking about. Not her fault, just a communication gap, I guess.
Yeah, this is Paul Gosselin. I'll jump in. And I think the items Evan mentioned that the Shack forwarded up, one, I believe, was the changes to the bylaws that they recommended up for the VINA GSA board to adopt. We need to have those reviewed by legal counsel, so I'll be sending those off for Valerie Kincaid for review. So once the goes through legal review, it'll be forwarded up and for consideration at the board meeting. So that's the reason why it wasn't on the agenda today.
Okay, all right. Did that answer your question, Bruce?
Yeah, and Paul, thank you for filling in. That's another learning thing I just got from Zoom, is that someone else who's aware of something can fill in. So that's really helpful. Thank you.
Okay, good. So we will adjourn to our next meeting on November 18th. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night.
Adios.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.